Welcome back to the Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're off to a flying start this episode, clearly. We're up to chapter 2 of book 8, and it goes like this. At the beginning of winter, Prince Nicholas Bolkonski and his daughter moved to Moscow. At that time, enthusiasm for the Emperor Alexander's regime had weakened, and a patriotic and anti-French tendency prevailed there, and this, together with his past and his intellect and his originality, at once made Prince Nicholas Bolkonski an object of particular respect to the Muscovites and the center of the Moscow opposition to the government. The prince had aged very much that year. He showed marked signs of senility, by a tendency to fall asleep, forgetfulness of quite recent events, remembrance of remote ones, and the childish vanity with which he accepted the role of head of the Moscow opposition. In spite of this, the old man inspired in all his visitors alike a feeling of respectful veneration, especially of an evening when he came in to tea in his old-fashioned coat and powdered wig and, aroused by anyone, told his abrupt stories of the past, or uttered yet more abrupt and scathing criticisms of the present. For them all, that old-fashioned house with its gigantic mirrors, pre-revolution furniture, powdered footmen, and the stern, shrewd old man, himself a relic of the past century, with his gentle daughter and the pretty Frenchwoman who were reverently devoted to him, presented a majestic and agreeable spectacle. But the visitors did not reflect that besides the couple of hours during which they saw their host, there were also 22 hours in the day during which the private and intimate life of the house continued. Latterly, the private life had become very trying for Princess Mary. There in Moscow she was deprived of her greatest pleasures, talks with the pilgrims and the solitude which refreshed her at Bald Hills, and she had none of the advantages and pleasures of city life. She did not go out into society. Everyone knew that her father would not let her go anywhere without him, and his failing health prevented his going out himself, so that she was not invited to dinners and evening parties. She had quite abandoned the hope of getting married. She saw the coldness and malevolence with which the old prince received and dismissed the young men, possible suitors, who sometimes appeared at their house. She had no friends. During this visit to Moscow, she had been disappointed in the two who had been nearest to her. Mademoiselle Bourienne, with whom she had never been able to be quite frank, had now become unpleasant to her, and for various reasons Princess Mary avoided her. Julie, with whom she had corresponded for the last 5 years, was in Moscow, but proved to be quite alien to her when they met. Just then Julie, who by the death of her brother had become one of the richest heiresses in Moscow, was in the full whirl of society pleasures. She was surrounded by young men who she fancied had suddenly learnt to appreciate her worth. Julie was at the stage in the life of a society woman when she feels that her last chance of marrying has come, and that her fate must be decided now or never. On Thursdays, Princess Mary remembered, with a mournful smile, that she now had no one to write to, since Julie, whose presence gave her no pleasure, was here and they met every week. Like the old émigré, who declined to marry the lady with whom he had spent his evenings for years, she regretted Julie's presence and having no one to write to. In Moscow, Princess Mary had no one to talk to, no one to whom to confide her sorrow, and much sorrow fell to her lot just then. The time for Prince Andrew's return and marriage was approaching, but his request to her to prepare his father for it had not been carried out. In fact, it seemed as if matters were quite hopeless, for at every mention of the young Countess Rostova, the old prince, who apart from that was usually in a bad temper, lost control of himself. Another lately added sorrow arose from the lessons she gave her six-year-old nephew. To her consternation, she detected in herself, in relation to little Nicholas, some symptoms of her father's irritability. However often she told herself that she must not get irritable when teaching her nephew, almost every time that pointer in hand she sat down to show him the French alphabet, she so longed to pour her own knowledge quickly and easily into the child, who was already afraid that Auntie might at any moment get angry, that, at his slightest inattention, she trembled, became flustered and heated, raised her voice, and sometimes pulled him by the arm and put him in the corner. Having put him in the corner, she would herself begin to cry over her cruel, evil nature, and little Nicholas, following her example, would sob, and without permission would leave his corner, come to her, pull her wet hands from her face, and comfort her. But what distressed the princess most of all was her father's irritability, which was always directed against her, and had of late amounted to cruelty. Had he forced her to prostrate herself to the ground all night, had he beaten her, or made her fetch wood or water, it would never have entered her mind to think her position hard, but this loving despot, the more cruel because he loved her and for that reason tormented himself and her, knew how not merely to hurt and humiliate her deliberately, but to show her that she was always to blame for everything. Of late he had exhibited a new trait that tormented Princess Mary more than anything else. This was his ever-increasing intimacy with Mademoiselle Bourienne. The idea that at the first moment of receiving the news of his son's intentions had occurred to him in jest, that if Andrew got married he himself would marry Bourienne, had evidently pleased him, and latterly he had persistently, and as it seemed to Princess Mary merely to offend her, shown special endearments to the companion and expressed his dissatisfaction with his daughter by demonstrations of love to Bourienne. One day in Moscow, in Princess Mary's presence, she thought her father did it purposely when she was there, the old prince kissed Mademoiselle Bourienne's hand and, drawing her to him, embraced her affectionately. Princess Mary flushed and ran out of the room. A few minutes later, Mademoiselle Bourienne came into Princess Mary's room, smiling and making cheerful remarks in her agreeable voice. Princess Mary hastily wiped away her tears, went resolutely up to Mademoiselle Bourienne, and evidently unconscious of what she was doing, began shouting in angry haste at the Frenchwoman, her voice breaking. "It's horrible, vile, inhuman to take advantage of the weakness." She did not finish. "Leave my room," she exclaimed, and burst into sobs. Next day the prince did not say a word to his daughter, but she noticed that at dinner he gave orders that Mademoiselle Bourienne should be served first. After dinner, when the footman handed coffee, and from habit began with the princess, the prince suddenly grew furious, threw his stick at Philip, and instantly gave instructions to have him conscripted for the army. "He doesn't obey. I said it twice, and he doesn't obey. She is the first person in this house. She is my best friend," cried the prince. "And if you allow yourself," he screamed in a fury, addressing Princess Mary for the first time, "to forget yourself again before her, as you dared to yesterday, I will show you who is master in this house. Go, don't let me set eyes on you. Beg her pardon." Princess Mary asked Mademoiselle Bourienne's pardon, and also her father's pardon for herself and for Philip the footman, who had begged for her intervention. At such moments, something like a pride of sacrifice gathered in her soul, and suddenly that father whom she had judged would look for his spectacles in her presence, fumbling near them and not seeing them, or would forget something that had just occurred, or take a false step with his failing legs, and turn to see if anyone had noticed his feebleness, or worst of all, at dinner, when there were no visitors to excite him, would suddenly fall asleep, letting his napkin drop and his shaking head sink over his plate. "He is old and feeble, and I dare to condemn him," she thought at such moments, with a feeling of revulsion against herself. All right, there we go. Another chapter down, and the cruelty of the old prince is affecting the mental health of Princess Mary. That's what I gather from that. She's being entirely too hard on herself and entirely too forgiving, and it seems that she's stuck in a home, in a living environment where it would be impossible to feel any kind of happiness. Oh, Bolkonski is he's becoming senile, and he's got this dementia that's starting to take over his mind, and it's making him more bitter and more cruel. Who was once delighted to ask the question, what are your thoughts on Prince Bolkonski's advancing dementia and Maya's reaction to it? JMama8779 said, in response to a short question, I'll give a short answer. It will be a great chapter when that crotchety old F-word kicks the bucket. Pardon the language, but geez, what an ass. Too Clever by 8715 said, agreed. Once that insane old man finally dies, the characters should all take a chapter off to celebrate. You know, when people suffer dementia and their mind goes, it can go one of two ways. They either become very bitter or they become kind of happy-go-lucky, I would say is the word. My grandpa has Alzheimer's and he's starting to show a lot of signs of dementia. And luckily, he's gone the kind of happy-go-lucky route. But I understand it's just as common, or maybe even more common, that they become bitter because they're somewhat aware of what's happening to their mind, which frustrates them. And it becomes this run-on effect, this feedback loop of frustration. Alice Lee said, this was a very uncomfortable chapter. Maya has spent her entire life isolated from society and emotionally abused by her father. Her father, always a jackass, is now clearly suffering from dementia and acting out even more than usual because of it. Some of my grandparents had the same and were meaner than they'd ever been earlier in life because of it. She has the unenviable position of trying to honour her father as he becomes more bizarre and unwell, while at the same time struggling against what the abuse has trained her over a lifetime to feel. I think that abuse explains her attitude towards practically everyone else. Why trust or like anyone when any moment of happiness could be snatched away in an instant by the mercurial habits of her father? I also feel terrible for Mademoiselle Boreen. Her livelihood depends upon this household and doing what is asked of her as a companion. I don't think she has much choice in this relationship with Prince Bolkonski. Relationship is in inverted commas. But Maya doesn't seem to acknowledge that. De Fleury said, holy cow, you feel pity for Boreen. You're even more of a saint than Princess Mary. I'll argue that Boreen had a choice about telling the old man how Mary yelled at her once and chose to cause trouble between father and daughter. Who was once delight jumped in to say, I don't feel pity for her exactly, but I can understand how she's grown so petty and conniving. She wasn't dealt a very good hand in life, but she's always lived around people who were. From her perspective, Maya's life probably seemed like a wasted opportunity. I wonder if Boreen thinks she would have done better if she had Maya's title and money. I could see her thinking that Maya doesn't even try. It's not wise or kind of her to be so unsympathetic, but it's human. Scourgy 1681 said, well said, I would love to read a novel from her point of view. She's someone somewhat of an anti-heroine like Becky Sharp in Vanity Fair. De Fleury said, sigh, it's okay with me if Mary goes postal at the end of the book. It was tough for me to see the bit where she was cruel to young Nicholas, to the young boy, in the same way that her father is cruel to her, and how she checked herself and became so ashamed that she cried in the corner, and then the boy comforted her in the same way that she comforted her father. Oh, it's just the cycle, isn't it? The cycle of life. You see it down the generations, and it was just this little echo, just like a microcosm of an echo. It wasn't to the same extent as what it's developed to be between Maya and her father, but you could just see the way generations mirror each other, and it was a little bit heartbreaking. Anyway, we're going to move on from this chapter now. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you again tomorrow.